Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we venture into early American history. My guest today is eminent early American historian Robert Middlecoff. Middlecoff is the winner of the Bancroft Prize for his book The Mathers, and his History of the American Revolution, The Glorious Cause, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and was the third book in the Oxford History of the United States. His latest book combines a history of the American Revolution with a biography of its most important leader, George Washington. There's always been a sense of mystique and reserve around Washington. He generally seemed more remote than other great Americans. Middlecoff, drawing on his extensive scholarship of the era, presents an interesting psychological detail about Washington's temperament, idiosyncrasies, and experiences, and how he grew into a leader, perhaps the first to understand the idea of being an American. That Washington's will and judgment were the primary attributes which helped determine the Revolution's course and led the way to the success of a new nation. The name of the book is Washington's Revolution, The Making of America's First Leader. It's published by Knopf. Robert Middlecoff is a professor of history emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley, a former director of the Huntington Library and Botanical Gardens, and a former visiting professor of American history at Oxford. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Robert Middlecoff, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
You know, there have been so many books about the Revolution and Washington in recent years. What were you hoping to add in telling your story of Washington, really the story of the Revolution and the immediate years after the Revolution, which I found fascinating because I don't think anybody ever tells that story. What were you trying to convey in your story about Washington?
Well, there are a number of things. One, I wanted to present him in the as full a context of the Revolution as possible. So the task, in a way, was to write both history and biography. I didn't want to give too much emphasis to the context or the background, but his greatness, after all, comes in the Revolution, and the history of the Revolution is a very interesting and a very rich history. So I wanted to see him in that context and not simply as a great political and moral figure. That was a big general conception, I suppose. But I also wanted to show his development from a Virginian who wasn't exactly born to the center of elite society, but from a family that was on the edges of that society, and how he made his way to the center of that society. It really came in the wars that he fought. And his development then as a Virginian into an American, and finally into what he called, and I came to realize, a citizen of the world, because what he came to embody was the hope of the world, the hope of the free, enlightened world. And in a sense, he became very close to the French. He learned a lot from them. So seeing that development was really key to what I tried to do in this book. And then the nitty-gritty story of the actual development of the war is very important. People forget that at the heart of the Revolution, there was a bloody, difficult, taxing, challenging war. And he fought that with the minimum of resources and fought it with great skill and saw it to a great conclusion. I think it's a really great story, for one thing.
As I always understood it, you know, Virginians really thought of the New Englanders, where the Revolution began, as sort of hotheads, and they came along slower to this idea of independence. But Washington seemed to be a leader.
There were a lot of hotheads in New England, and there was a great deal of leadership to the Revolution there, but it does have its hot-headed people in Virginia, too. Think about Patrick Henry, who as early as 1765 was saying things that might have been considered to be seditious or treason in the imperial sense. So there were some, especially young, really tough-minded people who were almost eager to bring on a break with Britain. Not many, but it certainly had its, Virginia had its own share of such people. As for Washington being a leader in the early movement, he at times was, I think, though he was often a quiet voice. He was a member of the Virginia legislature, the Virginia House of Burgesses, and there he was one among several Burgesses or planners who advocated a defense of American rights. He did hope, really, until the crisis over the Tea Party in Boston, that some middle way might be worked out, a way that protected American rights and self-government. Really, the Americans were virtually self-governing by this time. But he got behind and pushed hard for organized resistance, and certainly did play a very important role in its coming together in Virginia.
Well, as you examine Washington's character, you mentioned two parts of his character that sort of exemplified itself throughout his leadership of the Continental Army, and that would be his will and his judgment. First, his will to see the task through no matter how bleak it was, and as you write in the book, there were times when it was incredibly bleak, that it was only his force of will that kept that little army together, as well as his judgment. What are some of the best examples of those two attributes?
Well, the will, the powerful will, is pretty clear in his insistence that that after defeats, after battlefield defeats, some of them really shocking, for example, the one in New York in 1776, that his insistence that the fight go on, even though the problems he faced were so immense, the fact that the army suffered from short enlistments, the troops were always, it seemed, either coming or going. They weren't always in camp because their terms of service were so short. So he had to put together an army, and then when it began dissolving and reconstituted, he had to do this over and over again. That took a good deal of willpower, and then the mere fact of keeping it fed and clothed and provided with weapons was always a problem, and it seemed that the whole enterprise was going to come apart if somebody didn't really push hard, and he was, of course, at the forefront of really pushing hard, and so his will was clear, really, in the way he fought the war and held things together. His judgment is, maybe it's a trickier matter to really see, but you can see it in the way he dealt with civilian authority. That's one important place. The Congress, after all, was a set of delegates, in effect, from 13 states, each of them claiming its own sovereignty and independence. And he had somehow to navigate within a very complicated political situation, context, if you like, and while respecting the power and authority of the civilian government, still to extract support enough to keep the army alive and keep things going. He was urged to really take over full leadership. He could have made himself a dictator at certain points, or could have attempted to anyway, because the states were often so divided, so slow in coming forth with money and supplies and troops, seemingly sluggish almost at times. And so the judgment is clear, I think, in the subtle way he dealt with Congress, especially with the President of Congress. There are several men who served as President of Congress, and Washington was quite sincere and honest in giving way to them, and though he attempted to educate them in the complexities of his problems, the problems of actually maintaining an army and fighting a revolution and getting European support, he observed the proper lines of authority. He didn't transgress. He didn't cross those lines. Well, that took subtlety and judgment, I think. And then it's clear that in dealing with individuals throughout the United States, especially those sent by Congress to be generals in the Army, that took good judgment. It took a good deal of skill and firmness and thinking, really. A lot of thought went into all that. He showed good judgment in the way he dealt with the French, recognized that the French were immensely important, especially in their naval power. Nothing could be really won, he thought, without the support of the French Navy, and of course that was proved over and over again, especially near the end of the war when the French really were very important in holding off the British Navy off Virginia and transporting troops and supplies and making Yorktown the final great victory possible. So I think there was a good deal of good judgment shown there. I think it took a certain amount of restraint and judgment to not to complain publicly about the difficult situation he constantly faced.
And of course, in his correspondence, we see that he did complain, but it was always privately.
Yes. That's true.
Well, my guest today is Robert Middlecoff, a professor of history emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley. He was a Bancroft Prize winner and also had a wonderful book on the American Revolution titled The Glorious Cause. His latest book is titled Washington's Revolution, The Making of America's First Leader. It's published by Knopf. And earlier, Robert, you were talking about the evolution of George Washington from Virginian to American. When did that come about? Because as you know, when he first took over the army, this was during the Siege of Boston, it was kind of a bit of a culture shock for him. Wouldn't you say?
Yes, it was. That puts it very well. It was culture shock. I think it was a Democratic with a small d, aspect of New England culture that shocked him, and the measure of equality there, I think, was part of that culture shock. He certainly found New England to be very, very different.
And I think he went to New England more as a Virginian, and somewhere between the end of the New England campaign and the New York campaign, he becomes an American, wouldn't you say?
Well, that's a very important stage in his development as an American. I think it's at its most intense there in the early period. It is his experience, really, with all kinds of Americans and with the notion that here a people was coming into being, not just colonials of Virginia and New York and Massachusetts and Connecticut and so on, but an American people, the notion of that. And he felt this. This was a matter of feeling as well as of intellect. And it's the experience of the war and all of its complexities. And I think the sheer demands of the war that brought him into contact with so many different kinds of people, those strange New Englanders that he encountered in 1775 was only one part of it, but he certainly does become a very powerful in the sense of feeling, a powerful American, very patriotic American. He's very proud of America.
Now, you know, it's often said about Washington, he lost almost all of his battles, but won the war. And he did win some battles, but he did have a huge learning curve. After the success at Boston, he's defending New York. Of course, he makes a number of tactical errors in New York, but it was probably the first one was trying to absolutely defend New York against such a large force with a pretty untried army. And, of course, he is driven from New York, loses a lot of men, driven across New Jersey, settles on the Pennsylvania side of the Delaware. Of course, we remember the brilliant raid at Trenton and the New Jersey campaign, which sort of gave the army some a measure of success. But I would have to think his low point would have been the next campaign, which would be when the British decided to take Philadelphia. He loses most of the battles, but he said even after the Battle of Germantown, which was sort of ensured that the British would be in Philadelphia, he felt like, you know, we might have lost this battle, but he was absolutely sure that they were going to be victorious at the end. I mean, there was a strange sense of confidence coming out of those defeats when I would think that would be absolutely demoralizing. Where did that come from?
It came in part from that will that we've been talking about. There is a very strong moral and emotional constitution there. He isn't somebody who really could give up. He was a very powerful personally, and he knew he could win if he had the troops available. While it's true he did lose most of the engagements on the battlefield, there's a kind of triumph also throughout all of that in that things didn't disintegrate. He kept an army in being. No matter how hungry it was or how badly equipped and clothed and so on, he kept it together. And there was, I think, there were very many desperate moments, but he was always, because of his, on the mundane level, his organizing ability, his managerial ability to keep the army together, that was a source of some confidence, after all, that no matter what happened, there they were. They were still a force that had to be reckoned with. So that accounts for really a lot of the success that they did have, success in the midst of defeat. Trenton showed other things as well. It showed the Battle of Trenton and Princeton that immediately follows. So showed a certain amount of imagination, the way he pulled that off, crossing the river at night, a river that was filled with great ice floes, and the weather was absolutely ghastly, and then going back across the river after first smashing the British at Trenton and then returning again and making his way to Princeton and defeating the British again. All of that took a good deal of strategic sense and ability and again, of will and emotional power. He convinced people that he was giving them good leadership. You know, in the midst of all the defeat, he was still a very powerful presence for those around him, and that army sensed it. He was a very impressive man in every way, the physical being. The French commented on how well he rode horses, what a grand horseman he was. And in the 18th century, that was important.
Right.
I think we forget that in the automobile age, but that was very important. And then just in appearance, tall, good-looking, physically powerful, and quiet when he needed to be, and yet quite eloquent when he needed to be speaking. In every way, he is a presence, and that came through to the people around him.
Now, as I was reading through the book, I learned a couple of new incidents of the Revolution I never really knew before. One was that, you know, we're very fond of talking about the privations of Valley Forge, which was the winter after he lost Philadelphia. And, of course, that was a horrible winter. But you actually describe a winter a couple years down the road before Yorktown, where you had a part of the Army actually mutiny, and they were headed down the road to Philadelphia to get their back pay and basically to improve their conditions. It was that bad that that one of the best portions of the Army actually mutinied, and he had to put that down.
Yes.
And what was really interesting was, if you would think of the day and time of the age, it would normally mean, you know, mass executions. And he actually put it down with some gentleness, if you will.
Yes. The mutiny itself was for understandable purposes. It wasn't a mutiny that threatened to carry those mutineers into the arms of the British.
And that was the fear.
That was the fear, but it was certainly quickly dissipated because they made clear that what they were interested in were better support. They needed to be paid. They needed to think about their own families, and they couldn't do that if they weren't going to be paid and supported. So he recognized the dimensions and the limits of that mutiny right away, and he didn't put it down with any brutality, and he was made certain that the mutineers were listened to, and the whole thing was really settled in a short time.
He also had to, after Yorktown, we always forget, after Yorktown, there were two more years of, quote, war, where not a lot of battles happened, but the British were still in New York, and peace negotiations were going on, and the same thing sort of happened this time with the officers in 1782, I believe.
Yeah, especially in the spring of 83, at Newburgh, New York, where the main camp of the Army was, those officers were especially concerned about what they would do once this war was over, what kind of support they would have. Many of them had served, after all, for years, and many of them were in debt, their families were suffering, and they were concerned about both pay. Many of them had not been paid for months, and the Congress had notified them at various times that they would receive pensions, but really had done very little about it. So there was a serious talk. It never reached anything more than discussion and meetings about forcing the hand of Congress, forcing more support from Congress. Washington dealt with that in a brilliant meeting at Newburgh, in which he reminded the officers of the character of the revolution and how any forceful action by the corps of officers would subvert the great principles of civilian control and of political liberty as it had developed in America, of self-government, and reminded them of that in a very powerful emotional address at Newburgh in a very dramatic meeting. It's a wonderful performance by him. It was not anything that he just got up. He wasn't acting. He felt everything, I think, that he was saying. And it was an appeal that moved them, and that stopped any latent a talk of conspiracy.
You know, a lot of historians look at Washington's performance in the war and afterwards as the first president, and they always remark on the fact that he resisted what happened to Napoleon. You know, Napoleon was similarly greeted, but he made himself emperor. Washington didn't take over dictatorial powers during the Revolution. He believed in limited government. He served two terms and went home. How important is that in Washington's legacy?
Well, I think it's supremely important. I mean, he established a pattern, a a model, a set of standards for political governance and conduct that's been observed ever since, despite all the troubles we've had. The one great exception, of course, being the Civil War, but there we were fortunate in having another very gifted leader who saw us through the worst of that. But Washington's example was one that really had a very lasting effect.
Well, it's a really interesting book that is part biography, as you mentioned, but also a part history of the American Revolution, which you are intimately familiar with. You've now written about Benjamin Franklin and George Washington. Are you finished with writing about the Revolution, or are you thinking about writing about another figure from the Revolution?
Well, no, I'm not going to write any more about the Revolution. We'll continue to read about it. I'm lucky in that I'm in a university that has the greatest collection of Mark Twain papers in the world. His correspondence, the letters he wrote, the letters he received, manuscripts of most of his works, and a lot of other work. They're all in the Bancroft Library here on the campus of the University of California. And from my boyhood, I've been a great reader and fan of Mark Twain, and I've, in my spare moments, worked in those papers, and I think I'm going to write a book about Mark Twain. A very different man and a very different century.
Yeah. Well, we wish you success with that. The name of the new book is Washington's Revolution. Robert Middlecoff, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Rick.
American historian Robert Middlecoff is a professor of history emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of Washington's Revolution, The Making of America's First Leader. It's published by Knopf. Well, at Studio Tulsa for today, our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Taylor at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.